This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, September 26, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. A new report is raising concerns among government auditors over possible fraud in Hurricane Katrina reconstruction bids. Hurricane Rita touches down as a Category 3 storm, causing less damage than anticipated, but leaving people wondering if anything has been learned from Katrina. And we'll take a look at massive anti-war marches in the States and in Britain. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The IRA has rid itself of all weapons, international monitors say, 2 months after they said they would do so.
In a manner called for by the legislation. We have now reported to the British and Irish governments that we have observed and verified events to put beyond use very large quantities of arms, which we believe include all the arms in the IRA's possession. We have also made an inventory of them.
The IRA has used its weapons to fight the British rule in Northern Ireland, but many are skeptical of the IRA's move. They say the real test will be if and how they confront diplomatic relations in the political process in the coming months. In a high-profile trial against several people accused of participating in the September 11th attacks in New York, the Spanish High Court sentenced 18 people to prison who are accused of association with al-Qaeda. Maria Carrion reports.
Among the people sentenced was Imad Edin Barkat Adas, known as Abu Dada, who was sentenced to 27 years in prison for conspiring with the September 11th plotters. But the court threw out the most serious charges against Abu Dada and two others, clearing them of killing almost 3,000 people in the attacks. Journalist Taisira Looney, the Spanish-based Al Jazeera correspondent, was also given 7 years for helping to finance al-Qaeda. Looney, who maintained his innocence, is best known for having interviewed Osama bin Laden shortly after the September 11th attacks, and his sentence drew protests from Al Jazeera. Spain is also preparing to try over 100 people for their participation in the March 11th attacks on commuter trains in Madrid, which killed 191 people. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Maria Carrion in Madrid.
Soldiers deployed to protect a Chevron oil installation in Nigeria's Niger Delta region have attacked local villagers. Human rights groups have in the past accused Chevron of using the military to intimidate local people. Sam Alakoya reports from Lagos.
Residents of Idama village in Nigeria's Niger Delta region spoke of harrowing experience in the hands of soldiers who beat them with military rifles and electric cables. The soldiers said they were looking for guns taken from security men last week when militant youths protesting the arrest of their leader took over a nearby Chevron oil installation. The villagers say there is no justification for the attack, because those who took over the Chevron installation came from outside the community. Human rights violations in local communities in the Niger Delta are frequently carried out by soldiers assigned to guard oil installations which belong to Western oil companies. Human rights groups say most often such rights violations are initiated by the oil companies to put down local agitation for a share of the billions of dollars made yearly from oil exploitation. Some communities in the Niger Delta have instituted legal action against Chevron in the United States in connection with killings carried out by soldiers said to be acting on behalf of the company. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
University students, unions, and nationalists form protest as anger is felt in Puerto Rico over the killing of Puerto Rican nationalist Filiberto Ojeda Rios, who was gunned down on Saturday by the FBI. The FBI said they were trying to arrest him for a 1983 bank robbery in Connecticut, for which he was convicted in absentia in 1992 and wanted by federal officials ever since. Jorge Farinacci was a friend of Ojeda Rios. He explains why protesters are in the streets.
Mainly, there's two kind of statements. One of them is regarding Filiberto's position as a symbol of the Puerto Rican people, and also the second wave is regarding the criminal acts committed by the FBI in Puerto Rico, which by now everybody knows here in this island that he was murdered in cold blood. He was led to bleed to death. He also was tied up after he died by cords and then dragged around the yard and the house.
Ojeda Rios was leader of Puerto Rico's Boricua Popular Army, who sought independence from the U.S. His funeral will be held tomorrow, and 100,000 people are expected to attend. A leader of one of South Africa's trade unions called President Mugabe a denialist of that country's HIV/AIDS problem. Naeem Jina has more from Johannesburg.
Zaki Ahmed, chairperson of the South African HIV/AIDS lobby group, the Treatment Action Campaign, yesterday accused the government and particularly President Thabo Mbeki of coordinating a sustained attack on his organization. The TAC has been a consistent critic of the government's response to the AIDS pandemic and has confronted the Minister of Health in court on a number of occasions for the government's inadequate and inefficient provision of AIDS medication. The organization has also attacked Mbeki's position on AIDS, calling him and the health minister AIDS denialists. Ahmed, who was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for his work on HIV/AIDS, made the allegations at the TAC's annual conference on Saturday. The president has for long been criticized for his views on HIV and AIDS and for his support of AIDS dissidents, many of whom argue that HIV does not exist and that AIDS is caused by poverty and malnutrition. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Naeem Jina in Johannesburg.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell, WPFW in Washington, D.C.
Citing government records, the New York Times is reporting that more than 80% of the $1.5 billion in contracts signed by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, to clean up after Hurricane Katrina were awarded without bidding or with limited competition, leading auditors and government officials to be wary of possible fraud in Hurricane Katrina contracts. Testimony over private contract fraud, healthcare for Katrina survivors, and ways of paying for Hurricane Katrina emergency and reconstruction relief efforts will be some of the issues Capitol Hill will have to contend with. FSRN Selena Musuta has more.
The line between profiteering and doing good deeds in an emergency situation can be very thin.
Joshua Hotchberg is a partner at the law firm McKenna, Long & Aldridge. With Equity International and Republican Senator Mel Martinez of Florida, Hotchberg's firm hosted a Katrina Reconstruction Summit that outlined ways in which the corporate sector can be involved with emergency management and disaster response. Hotchberg told company representatives that fraud, waste, and abuse will be a reality in Hurricane Katrina reconstruction contracts, and that companies receiving contracts must be willing to protect themselves from being involved in any possibility of fraud.
You're going to see kickbacks and bribes and promises of future employment made to procurement officials. This is straight public corruption type issue, and it's one the FBI is well aware of it and is gearing to look at. You're going to see on a smaller level debit cards with people who have access to $250,000 authority with their debit card. Those cards will be misused. Contracts will be given to woefully unqualified companies, companies that, it turns out, belatedly are already under investigations.
The summit is one of dozens of Hurricane Katrina-related hearings and conferences that are taking place this week on the Capitol. Much of the more than $60 billion allocated for the Gulf Coast has gone towards quick assistance. The next step Congress will take is funding the rebuilding of the Gulf Coast infrastructure. Estimates of the cost for reconstruction have been as much as $250 billion. However, Bill Hoagland, Director of Budget and Appropriations for Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, believes that reconstruction costs will be far less than that. Hoagland also says that the offsets in health care Republican members have suggested to pay for Hurricane Katrina reconstruction efforts are not realistic.
I'm not opposed to offsets. I think we should try to find offsets for this. In principle, it's right. When you get down to the specifics, it gets a little bit more difficult. And the thing that the Republican study group came up with over in the House, I think they're all good proposals as dealing with health care costs in the future. But in this context of using this as a leverage to pay for Katrina, may be a little bit more difficult.
As well as dealing with payment of Hurricane Katrina reconstruction, there will be several Katrina-related oversight hearings. On Monday, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee unveiled a health care package aimed to aid Hurricane Katrina relief efforts. Susan Poland of the American Public Health Association says that some Republicans' efforts to delay Medicaid prescription drug benefits in order to offset the cost of Katrina is a mistake.
We agree that there should not be cuts to Medicare and Medicaid right now. This is not the time. This is a system that's going to actually need to step up and deal with even more. We believe that the CDC budget and the Environmental Protection Agency budget, two agencies which are on the front line trying to create communities and create environments where people can go back and live a healthy and safe life. It's going to be an expensive endeavor.
Selena Masuta, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
Hurricane Rita, once a Category 5 storm headed straight for Houston, turned into the biggest non-news story of the week when it weakened to a Category 3 and landed in a less populated area about 100 miles from Houston. But the emergency response in places it did hit raises questions about whether the lessons of Hurricane Katrina have been learned. When FSRN's Brian Edwards-Tiekert and Dolores M. Bernal toured the hard-hit refinery city of Port Arthur, Texas, emergency supplies were slow to arrive. There was no way for people who had weathered the storm to leave town, and no way for those who had evacuated to get back in.
On Saturday morning, Hurricane Rita made landfall as a Category 3 hurricane in Sabine Pass, Texas, right next to the refinery town of Port Arthur. On Sunday, transmission line towers were lying on their sides. Most buildings were missing parts of their roofs. Some flimsy prefab homes had been entirely lifted off their foundations, and floodwater was still pooled off the side of the highway. On the edge of town, state troopers turned residents away as they tried to return. David Wynn and his family were hoping to check on the status of their homes.
They said that there's gas leaks and electricity is still down and they don't want anybody in. And I said I had family in there and they said that they're still trying to get everybody out.
Inside the city, those who'd weathered the storm also reported trouble with authorities. Mike Torres, returning from a stint on a tugboat, missed the last bus out of town before the hurricane hit. Sunday morning, he was walking the city's ruined streets in a daze, trying to figure out how to get back to his home in Brownsville, 150 miles away.
I was walking towards Bruce's and Grove's, and the cop stopped me. I don't even know who the guy is, but he asked me if I live in Grove's and where I was going, and I tell him no. And I told him my situation. I was trying to go there, see if the place was open to cash a check, because I'm trying to get to Brownsville. So he told me, if you don't live in Grove, I suggest you turn around and walk back that way where you come from. That's what he told me. I tell him, okay. I did not give it him. I just walk.
Some people had managed to evade the roadblocks and return to the city. Sandra Herrera had just returned to her one-room house with her husband and two children. Between them, they had less than a gallon of drinkable water.
We didn't get too many provisions, and we'd had 4 days that there hasn't been any stores open, and we're running out. I hope they open soon, or I don't know what we will do. Parents can try to go hungry for a little while, but with children, then it's more difficult, since we have very little milk and water left.
At the command center set up in Port Arthur's blacked-out Holiday Inn, an exhausted Mayor Oscar Ortiz summed up the situation.
We've got no power in the city, no electricity, we've got no water, no sewer, no telephones, no nothing, no water, no ice, and we're trying to get some water and we're trying to get some ice in right now.
You worried about anything coming out of all those refineries?
Yeah, I'm worried about that too. We got a team over there that's going to look at the water, see if there's any contamination. We had some bubbling over there. We don't know if it's natural gas lines, chemical lines, or whatever they are. We're trying to find out what they are. And we got some crews going out there to try to bail them out and get that water out of the refinery. They got about 2 or 3 feet of water over there.
As Ortiz spoke, a long row of smokestacks across the highway were belching flame and black smoke, burning off excess gases left by a hurried shutdown. Advanced teams were beginning to set up housing for refinery repair crews. They say getting the refineries back online could take 3 to 5 weeks. The upside, said Mayor Ortiz, is that the city's evacuation was successful. He says 95% of the area's residents got out before the storm, and there have been no reported deaths among those who stayed. His biggest concern was for the condition of the town's evacuees at a shelter in Nacogdoches, where water and food were running low. Do you know where most people who evacuated got moved to? Was there one shelter?
Nacogdoches, Lufkin area, okay. Center. And that's what they're calling me now. They're running out of food up there, running out of water. And the Red Cross is over in Dallas. I don't know what the hell they're doing in Dallas. They should be in Nacogdoches and Lufkin and Center. That's where they're needed at.
It could be a long time until Port Arthur residents leave their shelters. Utility representatives estimate it will take a month to restore electricity. With Dolores M. Bernal, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, reporting from Port Arthur, Texas.
In Indonesia, over 30 people are hospitalized in intensive care, and so far at least 6 have died from bird flu. The country announced an extraordinary situation on the virus last week. The bird flu killed 65 people last year, and the World Health Organization says the virus has now reached its third step as an epidemic, spreading from birds to human beings. The last step, which normally occurs in about 3 months, would be a pandemic, where the virus would be spread among human beings and could affect 100 million lives in Southeast Asia. From Jakarta, FSRN's Maggie Margiono has more.
Indonesia's Minister of Health noted that if the bird flu or avian influenza continues to spread among humans, around 7 million lives in Indonesia are in danger. Indonesia currently lacks the vaccines to protect humans from the virus. Fortunately, the WHO and Australia today promised to deliver antivirus pills to Indonesia. Siti Fadila is Indonesia's Minister of Health.
Tomorrow, on September 27th, 10,000 pills from the WHO will be delivered, and then the next day, another 10,000 pills. And on Friday, some 20,000 will also come. Australia has also promised to transfer 40,000 pills.
The Indonesian government says the virus has reached 22 of the 30 provinces. The government has killed 59,000 roosters and hens to stop the spread of the virus. However, the extermination has stopped due to protests by husbandries demanding compensation and asking the government to buy all the hens and roosters that are burned. Fast food companies like McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken have a campaign that says eating chicken nowadays is still safe. But some say campaigns like these obstruct education campaigns about the virus. Iskander Sitoris, the director of Legal Aid for Health, says that the government should apply Indonesia's law on handling epidemic diseases. According to the law, people who obstruct the public health process in handling endemic diseases can be arrested and brought to justice.
If the government is serious, the government can implement Law No. 4, Year 1982, on handling endemic diseases. Does the government implement the law? No.
Iskander Sitoris also warns that the government should not be overly distracted in handling other diseases, like polio, that broke out a couple of months ago, and other killers like malaria, dengue, and tuberculosis. Reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta, I'm Eric Klein for Free Speech Radio News.
Just 2 weeks after Israel withdrew its troops from Gaza, violence has resumed. Palestinian militants fired a barrage of rockets from Gaza into Israel over the weekend, and Israel carried out a series of airstrikes, killing 6 militants. Israeli troops also arrested some 300 Palestinians in a sweep in the West Bank. The escalation comes as Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon faces a challenge inside his own party, where opponents of Israel's withdrawal from Gaza are seeking to hold early primaries so they can oust Sharon as a leader. Iris Mackler has more.
Israel's right-wing Likud party has begun to vote on the timing of its primaries. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon asserts they should be held next year, as scheduled. His opponents want them early. Essentially, this is a vote of no confidence in Sharon. At the opening meeting in Tel Aviv Sunday night, many party leaders spoke, but not the Prime Minister. Someone pulled the plug on the sound system so that he would not be able to be heard. And while allegations are flying within the Likud as to who was responsible, the unforgettable image of the night was the Prime Minister sitting there, silenced by his own party. Sharon's main rival spoke. Former Finance Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is seeking to harness anger in the Likud at Israel's withdrawal from Gaza and at the way Sharon imposed it on the party. We removed people from their homes, even the dead from their graves. And what did we get in exchange, asks Benjamin Netanyahu. We watched Palestinians burning synagogues, and now Hamas is taking charge in Gaza and will turn it into a center of terror. Certainly there has been an escalation in violence in Gaza over the past 72 hours, and it plays into Israeli party politics, for Netanyahu and against the Prime Minister. It began with an explosion at a rally in the Jabalia refugee camp Friday, one of a chain of rallies Hamas is holding to celebrate Israel's withdrawal from Gaza. 19 people were killed and more than 80 injured in what appears to have been the accidental detonation of a truckload of Hamas explosives. But the militant group didn't acknowledge that it was responsible, blaming Israel instead. This failure to tell the truth had serious consequences. Hamas militants, believing Israel to be responsible for the explosion, fired a barrage of rockets into Israel Saturday. 6 people were injured in the town of Sderot, and schools were closed in anticipation of further attacks. Israeli helicopter gunships then targeted Gaza in a series of attacks Saturday and Sunday, killing Palestinian militants in their offices and their vehicles. More than 20 bystanders were injured. As more evidence emerged of Hamas's responsibility for the explosion in the refugee camp, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas slammed Hamas. Abbas criticized Hamas for bringing large quantities of explosives to where people were gathered and then blaming someone else when things went wrong. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
Hundreds of thousands of protesters converged on the U.S. National Mall in Washington, D.C. for a weekend of rallies and events protesting the Bush administration, war, and corporate-led budgetary priorities. They strategized, chanted, sang, and, for the first time since the 1995 Oklahoma City bombings, marched past the White House. Dozens of people, including Cindy Sheehan, whose son was killed while serving in Iraq, were arrested today in a protest outside the White House for refusing to move after sitting down on the sidewalk. D.C. Radio Co-op's Reem Kakuda looks at the role of Arab Americans in the anti-war movement.
Bring the troops home! The Arab American community is here with you, and nobody is going to place Arab Americans on the margin of society.
Ilyas Rashmawi is a longtime social justice activist and a member of the governing bodies of both ANSAR, Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism, and the National Council of Arab Americans.
They cannot profit over the destitution of the folks in New Orleans and the destitution of folks in Palestine as we demand our right to return home.
This came at the unified rally held by ANSAR and UFPJ, United for Peace and Justice, after months of negotiations centered around strategic and probably political divergence on the issues around the occupation of Palestine and its people's right of return. An issue at the heart of the anti-colonial analysis of the war, as heard from remarks by ANSAR leadership and George Galloway, a member of the British Parliament.
This is not any clash of civilizations. This is not a war between the people of the West and the people of the East. This is not a war between Christianity and Islam.
The need for Arab Americans to be part of the anti-war movement was echoed by Simon Harik, an Arab Jesuit priest and the National Anti-Militarism Coordinator at the War Resisters League. As he was marching on the White House today and risking arrest along hundreds who stayed in D.C. for the Monday action.
I feel as though our people, the Arab people, you know, need to have a nonviolent witness. The Arab people are peace-loving people, but we're always portrayed as warlike and violent.
This weekend, Arab Americans in the leadership role in the anti-war movement told their story. Anas Shalal, Iraqi founder of the Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, emceeing for UFPJ.
With each siege of an Iraqi city, the insurgency is growing, hatred toward our military is growing, anger toward Americans is growing. Iraqis are telling us they have had enough of this bull. Why? Because when you kill innocent people, when you destroy someone's home, when you create conditions that make it not worth living, like cutting off water, electricity, or access to hospitals, you leave people little option but to join some kind of resistance.
Reem Kakuda, DC Radio Co-op.org, Washington, D.C.
Thousands of people also participated in Saturday's demonstrations all across Britain. Naomi Fowler was at the demonstration in Hyde Park and brings us this report.
The organizers say 100,000 people came to protest here. According to polls, most British people believe the London bombings wouldn't have happened if Britain had not participated in the invasion of Iraq. In Hyde Park, relatives of the 96 British soldiers who've died appealed for withdrawal by Christmas. Sue Smith's 21-year-old son was killed while on patrol in Iraq. She read out a letter she's written to Tony Blair.
Looking down on the face of a son that I had given birth to, loved with all my heart, knowing that I would never see him again. Please understand that I am one person talking for many, and you should listen to what your own people want. It's been 10 weeks today since my son was killed, and please, please, Mr. Blair, listen. There shouldn't be any more. Thank you.
Dr. Salam Ismail has come from working in Iraq.
To Mr. Blair, this is the statement of victims of his dirty war. I came from Talafa. I left there 2,500 families in the middle of desert, no water, no food, and with no doctors. I'm seeing the children dying in front of me. I cannot do anything there. When we enter inside this bombed cities of Al-Qaim, I swear only what I am doing, not treating, just collecting bodies, head, limbs. Mr. Blair, you lost the heart and minds because the heart and minds in the grave.
Anti-war campaigning veteran Tony Benn.
An illegal and an unwinnable war. It is a war for oil and power. We are demanding that the troops come out of Iraq and a date be set now. We want our political leaders to tell us the truth. If you can't believe your leaders, what possible meaning does democracy have?
Protesters also called for a public inquiry into the London bombings, solidarity with British Muslims, and for anti-terrorism legislation to be repealed. This is Naomi Fowler in Hyde Park, London, for Free Speech Radio News.
Tens of thousands also marched in San Francisco on Saturday. FSRN's Eric Klein spoke with a representative from a large and lively contingent there on the street.
All right, my name is Joshua Castro. I'm the Secretary General of the League of Filipino Students. We're here with the Strength and Unity Contingent, which is a contingent of people of color. And we're part of a larger coalition called Bagong Alyansan Makabayan, which is short for Bayan. That's Tagalog for the New Patriotic Alliance. It was formed in the Philippines, but we have a chapter in the United States to raise awareness about the issues going on in our homeland, the Philippines. And our calls for today are, number one, we're calling for the resignation or the immediate ouster of President Gloria Macapagal-Arroyo. She is a puppet of U.S. imperialism, and within her her term, she's committed grave mass atrocities and human rights violations with funding from the United States government and in the name of U.S. imperialism to exploit the Filipino people. Two, we're calling for the end of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, because much like the Philippines, it's also an example of the United States using their power, their military might, and their resources to exploit another third world nation like the Philippines. And also at the same time, we're criticizing the United States government severely for its lack of action in the recent Hurricane Katrina tragedy. And we just want to basically say all these three things are linked together. The fact that the United States does not care about people of color, does not care about third world peoples, and continually sees them as a means to further their exploitive demands in the world. So we want the U.S. out of the Philippines, but the U.S. out of Iraq, and we want the U.S. to actually give a shit about its people here in the United States as well.
That was Joshua Castro of Bayan, a Philippines-based peace and justice movement, speaking with FSRN's Eric Klein at this weekend's anti-war march in San Francisco. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.